When I was a young child, I discovered the use of a permanent marker in which I could take literally any object, draw on it, write on it, and the thing that I would write would show up permanently. It wouldn't go away. And I thought this was a fantastic idea. It was an incredible invention, something I didn't even know existed. And so I took this incredible piece of knowledge that I knew and decided that I was going to use it by drawing on every single item I could look at around the house. I drew on the walls, I drew on bedposts, and I even drew on a lot of my brother's stuffed animals and plushies. On top of that, I drew on maybe one or two of my own just to really throw my parents off my trail. You know, already at a young age, I was considerate of the legal system and made sure that, you know, if you want to throw off the scent, you got to make sure you look a little damaged too. Although, of course, considering I was the one holding the permanent marker, it didn't do me much good. But if little me had known about the multitude of legal defenses that exist out there, I might have stood the chance, because there are a lot of wacky defenses that have gotten people out of tough spots. Hello, and welcome to Jackie On, a podcast where I, Jackie, talk about my opinions on a bunch of different topics. This episode is Jackie On Wacky Legal Defenses and how they've been used. If you remember way back at the beginning of Jackie On, I talked about my favorite legal defense, which is the impossibility defense. And now I'm back and I wanted to share some other wacky legal defenses and maybe find you a favorite legal defense, but also because I think that truly sometimes when it comes to situations like mine, in which you have a ridiculous situation or even an expected situation, sometimes people have this tendency to create the most fabricated, crazy defense in order to justify what they did. And that's kind of what I want to talk about, how people came across these defenses and how they've even been used throughout, I guess, history. So let's start off strong with the Matrix defense. If you hear this and are immediately thinking about the age-old adage of "we're in the Matrix," that pretty much sums up this defense in four words. This defense is used to claim that you didn't realize the effects of the crime you committed because you believed you were in the Matrix, or a simulated world instead of the real world. And if this sounds like, okay, funny, whatever, this has actually been used and is often paired with an insanity defense for its defendants. A few examples of its usage is that in 2002, a woman named Tonda Lynn Ansley shot her landlady in the head and used this defense. She was ultimately found not guilty because of insanity and because of the knowledge that she had planned to kill others, including her husband, after believing they were trying to control her and issue her weird dreams, implying that she was in the Matrix. Similarly, in 2000, a man named Vadim Miskerges did the same thing, chopping up his landlady, and was declared mentally incompetent, and thus could not stand trial. He thought his landlady was emitting evil vibes and didn't want to get sucked into the Matrix, so he thought the crime was preventing harm. And I think it's really interesting that both of them did this kind of crime on their landlady. I don't know, maybe there's something about a landlady and the Matrix. I don't know. But these were the only two to really commit, with other cases either considering the explanation and changing their mind, or not being heavily weighed. For example, one person essentially said that they thought it was the Matrix, and they tried to claim this as a defense. And then later on, it was realized that they hadn't even been saying these kinds of things up until after the crime was committed. And so the defense team and the jury didn't accept this. And so they ended up switching the defense to being guilty instead of just, oh, I'm in the Matrix, because it didn't make any conceivable sense that this was their defense after not even believing it themselves. So again, if someone catches on and lawyers catch on, they will switch to pleading guilty. But I do think it's interesting that most of these cases have to do with some kind of insanity defense in which the movie somehow convinced them that they were living in the Matrix or living in some alternate timeline or universe, which is really interesting. Next is the Chewbacca defense. Now, this might sound like something that has grounds in science fiction or talking/grunting furry humanoids, but it has more to do with Chewbacca's ability to confuse and mislead opponents while Han Solo shoots them. A Chewbacca defense is one where the lawyer actually just tries to confuse the jury as much as possible rather than actually refute the prosecutor. It can be grouped in with the red herring logical fallacy, except this time in gross excess. And to be honest, the origin for this defense and its terminology is actually from a satirical case in South Park. While it was a real case kind of inspired, it was inspired by the O.J. Simpson case, in which they used the Chewbacca defense as a way to almost explain how O.J. Simpson was let off and acquitted when he shouldn't have been. And so they did this through the lawyer just being exceedingly confusing about everything going on and even name-dropping Chewbacca. It doesn't really exist, or it didn't until people saw that and started using it. And none of these usages have been particularly notable. It was more of just people trying to run with it or do some kind of confusing thing, and it never panned out, really. And some had used it without it being identified, and South Park helped to give it a name. So some people did have a case in which they just tried to confuse the jury as much as possible, and of course there was no name for it until South Park came along, and then the Chewbacca defense became known. Going off of that, one prominent example of this is the King Kong defense. So this defense doesn't even have its own Wikipedia page. Instead, it's mentioned in a page that covers the Pirate Bay trial. And to be fair, this is an umbrella under the Chewbacca defense, in which a lawyer claimed that to indict the client, it was necessary to prove that there was no connection to an online user named King Kong who may have been found in Cambodia and could have been the perpetrator instead of the defendant based on certain chats that were made and evidence that was displayed. It gets a bit complicated and strange from here, but regardless, it was a confusing argument meant to make a point about the possibility of a crime, much like the Chewbacca defense. So they're trying to throw the jury and the lawyers off of the defendant's trail by saying, oh look, actually, because of these reasons and this reason, there could have been some King Kong that actually did it. It was a strange argument. And because it was labeled and named in real life, people really draw comparisons between this one and Chewbacca, just because it really emulated the similar confusion aspect of the Chewbacca defense. But I feel like that one's not as interesting because they're more satirical. They're more fake or made up or weren't really put into that much use. Whereas this next defense was used very frequently and continues to be used, I think. It's called the idiot defense. Have you personally ever made a decision or done something that you didn't realize was going to have consequences and then it did? Well, welcome to the idiot defense. This is basically the same thing as giving your friend a bunch of money to fix your car, and then your friend doing something bad or illegal with that money, and blaming you for giving it to them. Only, how are you supposed to know this was going to happen? The idiot defense is often known to be kind of satirical based on the situation I already laid out. It's kind of obvious that, yeah, okay, you do have some blame, but not all the blame. Despite it being used mostly unsuccessfully as a way for defendants to claim innocence since they were ignorant of some facts that they probably should have been. In the friend example, it's if you know your friend is a gambler, for instance, then you know that by giving them money, they're likely going to gamble it away, and if they offend someone or do something illegal, blah, 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 onwards. It's more about you technically supposedly having knowledge about some bad activity, but acting as though you didn't have that knowledge or were ignorant of that knowledge. Funnily enough, or rather quite fitting, it has often been used by CEOs, which gives it the nickname of dumb CEO defense. A few examples of this happening are in Walter Forbes, the former CEO of CUC International, was charged with 16 counts of inflating earnings statements, and what ended up happening is that his lawyer claimed that his defense was not knowing about these earnings due to stakeholder influence. So basically, he was a CEO, but he didn't know that these numbers were being inflated. He was ultimately found guilty regardless, go figure, and ended up being charged with all 16 counts. So really, it didn't do anything to claim, oh yeah, he just didn't know about it. And in another case, Bernard J. Evers, the former CEO of WorldCom, claimed that the fraud committed by his CFO, who stole $11 million along with some other accomplices, was done without him being aware, and that he couldn't believe he trusted such a person. He, too, was convicted of all charges, because at the end of the day, you are still the CEO, you are still in charge, you're still operating the company, so you should still know when these kinds of things are happening, and must have done something to approve them along the way. There is a case in which this defense has been successfully used, and it was more where the person who was being charged with any kind of fraud account or something along those lines was not in the same amount of leadership position in which they oversaw the person who was committing the fraud. And so technically they could say they didn't know about it, and it is true, and they were not necessarily in a position to know about it. But in a CEO position or high leadership, you are expected to know these details and these facts, and so it's a little bit of a different situation. Thus, idiot defense. You should know that. You're just being dumb. So truthfully, being an idiot and not knowing anything doesn't necessarily make you cleared of any crimes. The next defense is another weird one, which is the Twinkie defense. If you've ever eaten so much of a food or sugary thing that you start to act unlike yourself, maybe going as far as to commit a crime and murder someone, then you might use the Twinkie defense. To be fair, this defense was not even the crux of a case that it was mentioned in. It's never been the pinpoint of a case. It just was almost used as a throwaway comment in a case and ended up becoming a big thing due to the nature of the case. So this case was actually against Dan White for murdering San Francisco City Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone. This is a very big case. It was widely known, very publicized. Movies were made about this case, or more the murder and the setup for it, less of the case. But Dan White's defense basically claimed that he had diminished capacity, which is essentially a term meaning that someone was impaired in some way and thus their sentence should be reduced. Their brain was not functioning at the normal capacity it does. Their judgment and their decisions should not be trusted to the same degree that they usually are. And since, in this case, it was depression that gave him a diminished capacity, they claim that it stemmed from, you guessed it, changing his healthy diet into eating Twinkies. Oh, to be fair, it was more about the eating Twinkies as a symptom and not the cause of his depression. But regardless, simply by his defendant saying that he changed healthy diets into eating sugary foods like Twinkies, the Twinkie defense as a name caught fire as a way of critiquing or even commenting about the case and the defense that went on. And so I think it's very interesting that some of these defenses might not even be super justifiable or even have strong bones to them, but they're more of ways that people have talked about these cases. And next I'm going to talk about two different unusual, wacky defenses that technically don't have strict names, like some of these have strict Wikipedia entries, but they are still weird defenses that have been used in general. The next one is what I like to call the doesn't fit defense, in which there have been two separate cases in which whether or not someone fits into a glove or a hole in the fence decided, or at least helped the jury decide, if they were guilty or not. Of course, there's what you likely know in the O.J. Simpson case, in the term, if it does not a fit, you must acquit, in reference to the gloves he used to commit the murder of his wife and acquaintance of hers. And essentially what happened is because of a number of factors and a lot of bad police etiquette done in this case, O.J. Simpson was acquitted, and part of that was because the gloves that he supposedly used to commit the crime did not fit him anymore. And we can go into a whole list of reasons as to why they may not have fit him. However, the whole crux of it was he didn't commit the crime if he didn't fit the gloves that were used to commit the crime. A similar argument was used in defense of a Japanese model, Serena Kozakura, who was convicted for destroying her boyfriend's property after he claimed she kicked a hole in the fence and then crawled through it. However, her conviction was thrown out because she had a larger bust than was possible to fit in the hole in the fence. So if she couldn't even fit in the singular hole in the fence, there was no possible way that she destroyed the property. At least that was what the response was, and thus the conviction was thrown out. Next is the evil twin defense, which is what one news site called it, in which in Malaysia, as background, transporting drugs is illegal and punishable by death. And one man in 2003 was convicted for transporting cannabis and opium. The only catch is that he had an identical twin brother, and they couldn't tell their brothers apart through looks, and their DNA perfectly matched. And because the judge didn't feel it was right to condemn a potentially innocent man to death, as there really was a 50-50 toss-up over which brother actually committed it, because the police didn't even remember which brother it was, and neither of them were gonna give up on the other. So what ended up happening is he acquitted both of them free of any charges. So this one was referred to as the evil twin defense because one of them was technically evil by doing this crime, and the other one was kind of just there, but you didn't know which was which, and thus you basically had to set them both free, or else one of the innocent men might be killed. And of course, there are plenty more wacky defenses that have been used in history. These are just the ones that people were either brilliant or stupid enough to use in the court of law. Not even in front of police. People make a lot of weird claims about reasons why they did stuff in front of police or when tested. But really, this is done in trials. This is done with lawyers. This is done systematically to see whether or not they could get away with a crime. And I think it's really interesting to see that even in the legal system, there's so many different, not loopholes, but there's so many different ways that you can pass through a system simply by the ways in which the crime was committed and the person who did it. So whether that's through impossibility, which it almost never is, or simply through something as interesting as claiming that your diet had changed your behavior, or that it simply you were too dumb to commit that crime, I think it's a fascinating way to look at the way our legal system works, and also just think about all the wacky defenses we have out there. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Jackie On. I'll catch you in the next one.